Hello all, this is Ellie and Holden calling in from GiveWell. We're going to give the people about 1 minute and then we're going to get started on the call. All right, we're going to get started. Just a quick note, you heard that the recording is on. Like all the things we do, we're going to record this call and post audio. We're also going to likely post a transcript. If there's anything that you say on the call that you would prefer not be included, please just let us know. We're happy to excise recording or the transcript. Right now, you'll note that your line is muted. We're doing that just to keep the call under control to some extent. You'll have a chance to ask questions later on in the call. If you want to do that, it would help us if you could just send us the phone number you're calling from so we're more easily able to identify you. I'll give more specific instructions for how to ask questions when we get to that point in the call. So the plan for this conversation is first I'm going to give a very brief overview of some of the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities. Then we'll pause for questions on that. We're hoping that the first set of questions focuses on our current or past top-rated charities. And then after we've gone through some of those questions, we're happy to move on for some of our plans for finding other top charities or giving opportunities in the future. And you know, as Eliza said in the announcement, we're planning to keep this reasonably, what I'm going to say, reasonably high level, because our assumption is that many of you have had a chance to read the detail that we've put out on our website already. So this is intentionally higher level. So just to quickly run through some of the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities, you know, GiveDirectly is the group that does direct cash transfers in Uganda and Kenya. We think that their strengths are that they have cash transfers, have reasonably strong evidence of effectiveness behind them. GiveDirectly itself has a particularly strong case for effectiveness because of a recent result from a randomized controlled trial of its program itself. This is something that Holden wrote a blog post on a couple days ago. We think they have among the larger funding gaps of the charities that are currently on our top list. They have pretty strong monitoring and evaluation of their own activities, and they've been very transparent with us about everything, so we feel like we have very good visibility into their process. They cash transfers and GiveDirectly are the group that if you put together our best estimates of cost effectiveness perform less well relative to the other top charities. SCI, or the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, is a group that does deworming. These are parasitic infections that affect many people in the developing world. As an organization, you know, they have less strong monitoring evaluation, and you know, we have written about some of the challenges we've had with fully understanding them over the years, though you know, that's something that I think has improved a lot recently. And they're the organization that, when putting together the explicit cost-effectiveness estimates, they come out most strong. The third organization, the Deworm the World Initiative, is one that is new on our list this year. They also do deworming, though they have an approach that is more focused on advocacy and assistance to governments rather than direct delivery of programs. They have, we believe, a more limited funding gap, particularly for their deworming, than the other groups on our top charities list. They're also part of a larger entity called Evidence Action, which implements another program focused on clean water. So they're not solely Evidence Action, which is the parent of both Deworm the World and Dispensers for Safe Water, is not solely a deworming organization. Also, among our top charities, they have the, I'd say, least direct monitoring and evaluation of their own activities that we've seen. And then finally, there's the Against Malaria Foundation, or AMF, which has been on our top charities list for a few years and is one that only appears there this year that we think has limited room for more funding. They're a group that, since we recommended them, hasn't distributed the bulk of their funds, and they now have about $12 million in the bank. So, you know, we're not seeking to move them significant funds this year, though, you know, we retain them on that top charities page because we think some donors may continue to choose to support them. So I wanted to pause there, briefly give some instructions for how to enter the Q&A queue in case you have questions that you'd like to ask. And then I'll also see if Holden wants to add anything to what I said. So just briefly, if you want to ask questions, you just have to hit *6. That'll put you into the Q&A queue, and then I'll be able to unmute your line, and you'll know that you're then able to ask the question. So feel free to do that at any time. You can sit in the queue as long as you want, and you'll also be able to continue following up on the question if you want. But before doing that, I just wanted to, well, so you can hit *6, but I want to give Holden a chance to add anything he wants to my summary of our top charities.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add on the individual charities. I think it's worth noting a couple of bigger picture things about how we're thinking about what these top charities are, how you should think of them as giving opportunities, and what kind of the whole Give Well Top Charities project means, because that's something that we've been thinking about a lot, and that I think we're a little bit, we're in the process of evolving on that. And so a couple things to bear in mind. One is if you go to our top charities page and you scroll to the bottom, or you go to our research process page and scroll to the bottom, you'll see a little section called pros and cons, I think, of giving to our top charities. And so this is us kind of acknowledging that there's, you know, there's a few different ways to think about giving, and there are arguments, I think, and more this year than in previous years for kind of saying, you know, there's, for example, this GiveWell Labs project going on. I think it's going to produce some interesting stuff. I want to save my money and see what comes up in the future. I think that's, like, a very defensible argument. I think that's part of what Good Ventures is doing by not closing all of the funding gaps for our top charities. So that's, like, one attitude one could take. I think also, you know, a lot of what we do with GiveWell Top Charities is we're trying to make sure that we're kind of creating a new dynamic that sort of creates an incentive for charities to share a lot of information, creates a dynamic in which we follow up charities, we learn about them over time, and the whole kind of, you know, giving ecosystem becomes healthier. I think this is a very important and very worthy goal, but people should know that we're factoring it into how we rank charities and how we list charities and all that. So we are now providing a list, I think it's off of our process page, that's kind of like all the charities that work on evidence-backed programs, reasonably cost-effective programs serving the global poor. And if someone wanted to say, you know, I think bed nets are the best, and I don't really value the kind of depth of GiveWell's process and the updates, and I want to just support bed nets, there are organizations on that list and doing other interventions that one could support. So, you know, I think it's helpful to have that context in mind. And the way that we think about our top charities is that the things that really distinguish them from other charities, and they continue to distinguish them, are A, that they do work on evidence-backed programs, cost-effective programs serving the global poor, and B, they are charities that we know a lot about because they've agreed to participate in our process and they've shared a lot of information with us. And so when we think about who's a top charity and how much money are we trying to get to the different top charities, one of the things we're thinking about is incentives, is creating incentives to participate in that process. One of the things we're thinking about is learning, making sure that all these charities get enough that we'll be able to keep doing updates on them. And so, you know, part of our ranking reflects our goals for the kind of the GiveWell Top Charities project. And, you know, I think there's also arguments for saving your money, for giving to another charity, although I personally think that giving to our top charities is all things considered with everything factored in is a really excellent thing to do with your money.
So we're just waiting for people to enter the Q&A queue. You have to hit *6 to do that, and then we can unmute your line. So we're just waiting for that, and then we'll move forward. All right, it looks like we might be having a technical difficulty with the queue, so give me one moment, and I'll see if we can fix it.
We can go to email if we have to. That's always worked well in the past.
All right, it looks like we have a problem with this Q&A session. So if people don't mind, please send in any questions to info@giveall.org, and we'll do our best. We'll read them out. We'll see if we can fix this snafu with the conference line to allow you to ask your own questions. But in the meantime, just email in any questions to info@givewell.org, info@givewell.org. So we got a question in over email that we're going to answer. The question is, GiveDirectly has received a lot of press recently, and so we'd imagine that their funds received are going to be a lot higher this season. How does our minimum take that into account? And are we in regular contact with them about their fundraise? We have thought about this. It's very hard to predict the funds that Give Directly will receive, but you know, we basically think that the minimum that we set that we'd like to see them receive is something that we think they'll receive from GiveWell donors, including the Good Ventures grant, regardless of the additional media attention. And so we think Give Directly is pretty likely to hit the minimum. You know, I think that we're the sort of flip side to that question is how likely they are to hit a much higher number of funds. You know, we've written that we'd be comfortable seeing them receive on the order of $5 to $20 million. Obviously, as it reaches the higher end, the you know, the need for the funds falls in terms of Give Directly's ability to grow. And I think there's, you know, it's unlikely that they go beyond the top end of the funds that they can effectively use.
A couple more things. One, I mean, yes, we are in regular contact with them. I think we'll know if they're, you know, getting up into the millions from other sources. And that's something we'll be monitoring, and we'll certainly, you know, do something about it if it happens. And two is I definitely would not assume that media translates into big donations. And certainly we can speak from personal experience here. I mean, we've had some pretty big media coverage of ourselves. We've seen what that does. We've seen what the other sources of money moved are. And I mean, my guess is that the press Give Directly got is not going to lead to the kind of money move that we're talking about here. And it's possible that I'm wrong, but I certainly don't think it would be my starting assumption.
Okay, so, you know, please continue to email in any questions to info if you have them. Another thing that we can try is if you'd like to ask your own questions, we can email in your phone number, and I think I should be able to unmute your line directly. So I know that we have a couple questions from Rob Wiblin, and so I'm going to go ahead and, Rob, unmute you so you're able to ask the questions that you have.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Yeah, I just emailed through a question about AMF's room for more funding issue. I'm Robert Wiblin from Giving What We Can / the Center for Effective Altruism. And we're having to make the call about whether to follow your lead in temporarily suspending the recommendation of AMF until they manage to close a distribution that uses up a significant share of their reserves. And at the moment, we're leaning against doing so, that we're not sure what we're going to do. And the reason for that is that my estimate of the likelihood that AMF will, in the next 5 years, use marginal donations on a high-quality rollout has gone from something like 90% to now about 80%. And if you just put this into the expected value formula, this implies only a fairly modest reduction in their overall cost effectiveness. And so my attitude to them hasn't really changed all that much. And it also seems, at least for Giving What We Can, that we're going to know a lot more about whether their current negotiations with a couple of countries are going to mature into distributions in just a couple of months' time. And so there's a strong temptation to wait until we know more about whether that's going to happen, rather than to suspend them now, and then you know, be more likely than not to recommend them again in just a couple of months' time. So I think that you believe that this approach is defensible, though you've erred on in the other direction. But why do you think it's the wrong choice, at least for GiveWell, on balance?
So a couple things. So one, I think the question of what's the probability that AMF uses funds in the next 5 years is not a very – like, I don't think that's the question to focus on. You might want to talk about, I mean, if you're determined to give in December, which I think you arguably should not be, you might want to talk about the question of what's the probability that AMF uses their funds in the next 12 months. Because, I mean, if AMF is going to use its funds in 3 years, I mean, then I think the right thing to do is save if AMF is where you want to give, and give then, or just give now and give more to AMF later, with donations you would have given somewhere else otherwise. So, I mean, basically the thinking is on a couple fronts here. One is that watching and waiting and saying, okay, I'm gonna wait until AMF spends a lot of the funds it has before giving, I think at this point is, you know, is to me, seems like a more attractive strategy than just giving to AMF now in the hope that those funds will be spent eventually. I think, you know, I think a five-year time horizon is really long. I think that giving compounds and also has option value, and so I think money not getting spent for 5 years would be a pretty undesirable outcome. So that's part of the thinking. You know, also, I mean, we're mindful of what our recommendation means and what the signaling around that is, and I think we wanted there to be kind of a definite consequence to the fact that the money we've recommended over the last couple of years is still in the bank. And, you know, our kind of attitude is, well, the recommendation comes back when we feel that the money's moving out the door. So, it's, you know, in terms of incentives, we feel there's value to that. So, you know, I guess those are a couple of the things that I would say on that front. With that said, I mean, I think it is definitely defensible to give to AMF, or what in my opinion is a bit more defensible would be to kind of watch and wait. And if you want to give to AMF, you know, watch and wait and see what they do in the next few months. I do think that the fact that they're discussing other distributions that will have more information on the next couple months is also a fact that's probably been true at most points in time over the last year or two. So I don't think that, like, this is an especially good time to say, oh, I want to wait 2 months, but I think it's a perfectly fine time to do so. And AMF remains on our top charities page. It's not classified as a top charity right now. It's not classified as a recommended charity. We want people to know that there's a holdup with these funds. We wanted the kind of, you know, the attention that it got for saying this is an issue and we're not going to just keep kind of blindly recommending them. But it's also, you know, it's on our top charities page, and so it's a pretty salient option still for donors. I mean, if you just right below the top three charities, we talk about AMF, we talk about the fact that we still think they're great and doing great work, but we've got issues with them for funding, we link to more information. So, you know, all in all, I think the presentation we're giving of AMF is the right thing to be doing. And I think if you're looking to give this year, and especially if you're looking to participate in the kind of incentive ecosystem that we described before, I do think our other three recommended charities are probably a better choice at this time. But, you know, I won't be surprised if AMF gets back on that list, and it could happen fairly quickly, and I wouldn't see a problem with that.
Just one thing that I wanted to add is, you know, I think the likelihood that giving to AMF is really supporting better monitoring and higher quality distributions as opposed to funds otherwise wouldn't have been funded, the possibility of that being the case has risen because of changes in the global funding situation for NETS. Previously, there was an extraordinarily large gap for NETS on the order of $500 million, largely it seems related to the global recession, the cost of NETS, and the global fund having some problems. Those three things have changed in the last year, and the global funding for net situation for NETS has improved. That doesn't mean it doesn't make sense to give to AMF. It does mean that there's an additional factor that's worth considering when you think about the likely cost effectiveness, let's say, of additional funding for bed nets. All right, we're going to move on to another question. I'm going to Joey. You emailed in some questions, and I'm going to unmute you so you're able to ask.
Great. Can you guys hear me?
Yep, we hear you.
Okay, so I just had a question about Deworm the World. You said that you spoke to three government officials who were involved, and they kind of explained whether they thought it had an impact or not. But all the conversations took place with Deworm the World staff there. Do you think this has an effect on the response, like making it more positive? And if so, do you have like data that points in the same direction but maybe doesn't have that bias?
Sure. So it is absolutely true that the conversations we had with government officials all had multiple Deworm the World representatives present, and I am worried about the bias there. With that said, you know, one of the three conversations, the guy really downplayed the role of Deworm the World and kind of said it, you know, it hadn't had a very important role. In some ways, you could take that as a negative sign. You could also take it as a positive sign, and I would, about the power dynamic and about the presence of bias. And, I did kind of come away thinking, you know, okay, it might feel a little awkward to say certain things with people in the room, to say something useless or whatever, but we had fairly in-depth conversations with these people. We published notes on our site, you know, at our site visits page, and we got fairly concrete about it, and we asked, you know, what did Deworm the World do? What did they do that you couldn't have done otherwise? And you know, I don't really think that that the given the power dynamic, given kind of how high up the people we're talking to were, my guess is that they didn't, it wouldn't have been worth it to them to kind of really fabricate answers to all these questions the way that they did. So it's not like we just walked in there and said, was the War in the World good, yes or no? I mean, we kind of, you know, one example was when we talked to that, to the highest up of the three, she was talking about the importance of having a technical partner and feeling confident about a program. We said, are there other programs that you wish you could run, but you're not because you haven't found a technical partner? And she said yes, and she gave an example that was, like, very concrete. And then she kind of harped on it and, you know, and wanted us to help her find a technical partner. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, I felt fairly good about it. You know, also, I think it is definitely relevant, and I think and I hope that we say this in the review, just in terms of the deworming programs that have happened in India have generally involved Deworm the World as a technical partner, and I think there's, like, only one that didn't, and it kind of got discontinued. So, you know, with all that taken into account, I feel pretty good that Deworm the World had an impact, but it is an intuition, and it is a judgment call, and it is a lot less certain than a lot of our other charities, and we're happy to be open about that and let people take that into account.
So we don't have any other questions right now on our current top charities. If anyone has more questions like that, email them in. One thing I wanted to clarify, because I wanted to just make sure that it's clear what we mean by these minimum targets. We've talked about these minimum targets, and Good Ventures filled 75% of the targets that we saw. And our belief is that those targets will be met by donors who are not reading all of, you know, who wouldn't be swayed by all of the details of the different funding gaps and strengths and weaknesses. And so I think it's appropriate, our advice to the donor community who wants to have our best guess is that the minimum targets will be met, and you should think about yourself as giving above and beyond the minimum targets for all of the organizations. You obviously could disagree with our judgment on that point, but that is our best guess about what will happen. So I don't see any more questions on the top charities. So, Tiago, I was going to unmute you because you had a question that related to something else. Sorry, you should be unmuted now. Go ahead.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Well, my question was about this new approach that you have about evaluating advocacy groups and giving to them, and what plans you have on that.
Sure. So the, I mean, I will say that Deworm the World is partly an advocacy group, and I think all of these organizations, all of our top charities, engage in some sort of degree of public advocacy, and that's part of their value added. But in general, you know, in general, what we're doing with our top charities is we're looking for charities that focus on evidence-backed programs serving the global poor, and we're kind of just using our, I mean, we're looking for evidence of effectiveness, and we're looking for the normal things. We're not really thinking of that. I mean, I'm happy to answer that question, but we're not really thinking of that as primarily an evaluation of advocacy organizations. And so I think your question mostly applies to GiveWell Labs, which is the newer project in which we're open to a broad variety of different kinds of charities doing very different kinds of things. And on that front, we recently published a series of 4 blog posts on how to think about what we call policy-oriented philanthropy, which is giving with an intent to focus on changing public policy. So, I mean, I think those are definitely worth reading. They're very recent posts on the blog. And, you know, right now, I mean, I think we're still sort of at a stage of getting immersed and picking up the basics of political advocacy, but we're looking into several issues and kind of trying to pick the ones that do fairly well, both in terms of being important in humanitarian terms, but also in terms of having some potential political tractability. And then we're going to try and pick a couple of the best causes and really get involved in them. And that's something that we're starting to do now with criminal justice reform, with labor mobility. And a lot of what we're doing right now is just exploring what are all the different kinds of activity that one could fund to try and change policy, and how do they all fit together, and how can we move forward. So, you know, the main thing that I have to say is that we're not going to have kind of necessarily a formula for evaluating political advocacy, and we certainly don't have that formula right now. it could take a very different form from our top charities. It could be not so much recommending organizations as trying to recommend whole coalitions of groups or recommending that people invest in issues in general. So we're not sure exactly what it's going to look like, but the main thing we're thinking about right now is how to pick issues that are somewhat tractable and that are also important, and then how to just, in a very open-ended way, explore those issues, look for all the different things that can be done by a philanthropist, and kind of, you know, put all the pieces together as a strategy, because that's something that philanthropists often do, is they're thinking about the bigger picture strategy instead of just funding a particular organization.
Right, thank you.
Okay, so, you know, if you have questions, feel, you know, please email them in. We're going to try one more time with the phone keys, so you should be able to, we're going to see if the star six thing works again, so feel free to give that a try or call in. In the meantime, I know that, Rob, you mentioned that you had a few more, you had a few responses and questions about AMF, so I'll unmute you and we'll go from there. But, you know, for others, feel free to hit star six or send in your questions via email.
Sure. So I had a couple of responses. The first one was that I agree that in the ideal world, we'll probably tell donors to hold on to their money for a couple of months and make a decision then once we have more information about AMF. Or perhaps just that holding on to their money for a bit longer is a good idea because we'll get more clarity on a whole range of charity evaluation issues. I guess we're in the difficult spot that some donors are really keen to give in the next 30 days. But I think even then, on balance, I'd probably rather that someone gave to AMF today rather than SCI or Give Directly or even Do One the World, just based on confidence about the insecticide-treated bednet intervention. Even given now some of the doubts about room for more funding. I guess that's not a very strong view, but I lean towards that. And the other thing is I'm not sure about the incentive effects that this creates for AMF or Rob Mather. I mean, it seems to me like they're working pretty hard to try to get a distribution going. I'm not sure that withholding the recommendation this year is going to get them to work much harder. I mean, maybe it will cause them to reassess their method and perhaps bring other people on board to try to reach a distribution. But it seems like they're pretty motivated already, at least in that specific case.
So a couple of responses on that. First off, I mean, I disagree with you. I'd rather see donations go to the other top three charities than go to AMF from kind of from a pure impact perspective, I think, although it's not an easy one, I agree. But I think that donations that get into the field more quickly and help people more quickly are better, all else equal. So it's not, to me, just a matter of multiplying by probability that something takes place in, you know, at some point within the next few years, but it's thinking about how fast it's going to take place and, you know, how much of a delay there's going to be. So that's a response to the first point. I agree it's very debatable, and, you know, we certainly don't think we have all the answers here, but that is my opinion for what it's worth. As far as incentives go, I think it's important to distinguish because, you know, the kind of way that you portrayed talking about incentives was like the incentives for Rob and the incentives for AMF and the incentives this year. But I think something that GiveWell has pretty consistently valued is what is the signal we're sending to all the people who are thinking about becoming GiveWell top charities? What does it mean to be a GiveWell top charity? What does it take? When do you go on? When do you go off? And we're sending that signal to charities, and we're sending that signal to our audience. And I think that we're setting the right signal and the right incentives when we say a GiveWell top charity is a charity that is open, that is accountable, that is transparent, and that is also sort of in good standing, that is getting the money it spends out the door in a cost-effective manner, that isn't kind of experiencing this sort of major delay. So I think this is basically the right picture in terms of like what other charities should expect in terms of what it takes to have a GiveWell recommendation. And I think that is a very different question from like what affects, you know, Rob and his incentives today, which I think is a much dicier question. And I would tend to agree with you that isn't a major factor there.
Cool. Am I still on?
Yeah, you're still on.
Okay. I like all of that. I was just going to say on the discount rate issue, I used to think that there was a very high degree of urgency to get money out the door. But having read a blog post by Paul Cristiano on this topic, which you may have read, I've now lowered the discount rate rule of thumb that I'm using to something like 5 to 10% per year. It's probably too complicated to talk about it here. It would be better off doing it in writing, but perhaps we can discuss that later.
Sure.
Thanks.
So does anyone else, you know, we don't have any, no one's in the queue. There's no questions right now in on info@givewell. You can either hit star six and then follow the prompts. I think you have to hit one to enter the Q&A queue, and we can unmute you, or you can, if you'd prefer, email in your question to, you know, to info@givewell.org, and we can read it directly. So we'll give people a little bit of time, and if there aren't questions, I think we'll just, you know, call it. All right, so I'm unmuting someone here who's in the queue to ask a question. Sorry, I don't know who you are.
Hi, this is Eric Friedman. Can you hear me?
Oh, hey, Eric. Yeah, we can hear you.
Hey, my question, you talked a few times about the importance of participating in GiveWell's process for the recommendations. So one of the things I've been thinking about is, you know, to what extent is this excluding charities that are potentially doing, you know, very good, comparable, if not better things? And, you know, if so, are those charities identifiable without going through GiveWell's process? And in essence, you know, what is the cost from an impact perspective of that decision to require such a rigorous process? And so I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Sure, I'm happy to talk about that. So, you know, I think it is a definite risk that we miss charities that, you know, are good and haven't gone through our process. I think it's happened in the past. I think it's probably happening now. You know, we don't know which those charities are, and that is definitely a major issue that makes me kind of not really believe there's one outstanding candidate. You know, so we definitely concede this is an issue, and we have modified our presentation to try and accommodate people like you. So if you want to go and take a look at all the charities that kind of fit our eligibility criteria, meaning they work on evidence-backed programs serving the global poor that are relatively cost-effective, and you want to pick one that you think is better and that you think is going to do more good, and you think that kind of outweighs the sort of ecosystem issues I've talked about, I mean, we've tried to make it easier for you to do that. So that's response number one. I mean, response number two is if we saw a situation in which we thought that all things considered, with everything taken into account, there's another charity that was doing more good than our top charities, even though we were guessing because it hadn't participated in our process, I think we would find a way to highlight that and at least make people aware of it. So I'm not saying we would make it a top charity. I think we'd have to decide. You know, I'm not saying how much sort of money we would try to get to it, but we would at least try to really highlight that and really think it through. And if we saw a giving opportunity that we thought was, you know, important to take and was a certain size, then we would think about what we could do. So I can tell you that we're not aware of anything like that. I can tell you that if you go look through those top charities, what in my opinion you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of charities whose programs are like roughly in the ballpark of the ones we're recommending in terms of potential bang for your buck, in terms of value. You know, and given that, I think that it's worth raising the question, all right, how valuable is this ecosystem thing that I'm talking about? How valuable are these incentives? And I think this is something that a couple of years ago was a lot less of a strong argument than it is now, because I think we've seen this kind of reasoning work out over time, I believe. Because the charities that we're recommending now, I mean, SCI and Deworm the World, certainly, their willingness to participate in our process rose dramatically, I believe, in a way that it wouldn't have and couldn't have if we had not made participation a condition of being recommended. So we had just gone ahead and sort of recommended them and not at any point said, okay, now we have to see transparency or else it's not happening. I don't think we would know as much about them as we do today. And so I think that's definitely worth considering. I think that our ability to engage charities and to get this kind of information has just improved so dramatically over the years. And when I think about what the next few years are going to look like, what I think is that we're just going to get very rapidly better at engaging with the charities that meet our criteria and figuring out the story. So I think, you know, I think there's a great deal of value to that. I think there's someone should not weigh sort of being a part of that dynamic lightly because of what we've seen so far. And so I think, you know, when you've got a bunch of charities where there's no obvious kind of dominator, then I think that's something to strongly take into account, and that's where we stand. But again, I don't think that's the world's most obvious call.
So are there a lot of charities that participate in your process that don't get selected, or are you kind of just selecting from, you know, a very small number?
We're mostly selecting from a small number. It has happened that there's been a charity that participated in our process and didn't get recommended. We're generally not going to be, like, able to talk about that stuff because charities will say, well, we don't want you writing anything about us, and we've kind of agreed to that as a condition of opening up the investigation because we want them to engage with us. And that's something we may change over time. Like, we may start taking away that option, and actually probably will. So, I would say that generally, I mean, something that happens a fair amount is that there's some initial back and forth, and then we're sort of all saying, okay, this is not going to turn into a recommendation. The ones that go through, like, a really deep vetting, most of them, but not all of them, have become top charities. And partly that's because, you know, we see value just in going through the process. And so even a charity that kind of, like, we said, well, this one really looks like it isn't effective, we'd still want to give them some kind of, that would not be a top charity, but we'd still want to give them some kind of shout out or recognition for being open like that and for contributing to that ecosystem. So, the basic story is that when we go all the way with a charity and we really do that deep dive, it's generally leading to a recommendation. There's few exceptions to that. But I don't really think that undermines what I'm saying.
When AMF got recommended a long time ago, they presumably started seeing a lot of money move towards them. Did the other malaria bednet organizations, did they change how they interacted with you?
They've not in a fundamental way. I mean, we have heard from a couple of them with interest for applying for our recommendation, and we've described our process. We know that we need a lot of time from them, and so we often, beyond explaining our process and being willing to engage, we are waiting for them to demonstrate that they, you know, want to engage and are ready to.
Well, Elliot, I don't want to name names because I don't know what we're allowed to say, but I would say there's definitely been a directional change. I mean, like, certain organizations that really showed very little interest before have expressed a lot more interest now in a very different way. And then it's a question of, like, did that come through in time for us to open something up this year? Are we waiting for them to show more interest before we really move forward, et cetera? But, I think that's something that's changed. I also think it's important, like, to not just look at bednet organizations because I don't really think that's the relevant comparison class. I think it's important to look at what's going on with charities. How is our access to charities changing, and how would it change if we weren't operating this way? And I think that's where the picture is fairly clear.
Have you considered a more the larger multi kind of multi-service, multi-project organization if they were willing to be more transparent about it, or is that kind of off the list for reasons you've described many
that's
times?
That's now on the table because we feel like the money moved is getting big enough that it's starting to make sense to have those conversations. And so that, there was an organization we spoke to this year on that front that basically we didn't think we were going to be able to get enough information from them in time, and we're going to speak to them again next year. But that sort of operation is now on the table.
Okay.
And it really, I mean, this is maybe last year we kind of looked into it a little bit, but I would say it's more on the table than it's ever been before.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. Thanks, Eric. So I wanted to give David a chance to ask some questions. David, you should be unmuted now. David, are you there? Okay.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, I had my phone muted as well. So we're going muted. So some of my questions are, I was wondering if you're making the entire data set for this year's evaluations public. So how many companies actually went through the entire evaluation process? And you might have posted some of this before, but I was kind of curious about that. And then I was kind of wondering, what is your sort of adoption policy? What is your strategy for getting more organizations, and what are the types of barriers that you're sort of finding in terms of getting access to nonprofits?
Right, got it. So, I mean, GiveWell's evolved over a number of years with how we engage with organizations. Over the course of our history, we've probably looked at several hundred, if not more than that, or considered at least, organizations to see if they would be a good fit for our process. Our criteria are such that many organizations that are working internationally are not a good fit. We're looking for organizations that are running evidence-backed programs and ones that are ready and willing to engage in a pretty lengthy, deep process of investigation. And so we have a list now of roughly 60 or so organizations that we think possibly could be a fit for our recommendations in future years. And they're the ones that we have and we continue to plan to reach out to encourage them to participate if they want to. But as Holden was saying before, if they don't want to, there's not very much we feel we can or should do to try to get them to participate. I think that, organizations have, for us to get the types of benefits that we want in terms of learning and in terms of improving the conversation around charities, we really need organizations that are excited about the opportunity to engage with us, and not organizations that want to just engage at a perfunctory level because of the opportunity to get some additional funding.
So I want to add a couple things to that. I mean, I think one is that it's, in terms of what we do in order to make engagement more likely, I mean, I think there are a couple things. I think the biggest factor by far is the money moved. And so when we're able to show, okay, sharing a lot of information, being accountable, being kind of thoroughly investigated and sharing substance leads to a lot of money, that leads to more interest. I think that's something we've seen very concretely over the years, and that's a change we've seen that I expect to continue. The other thing is, we think about how we can make this process workable for top charities, how we can make it more transparent to them, more understandable, how we can make it, lower risk. So this kind of practice of saying, well, if you want to pull out of this process and have us write nothing, we'll do it. I mean, we instituted that a couple of years ago because we were trying to reduce the risk to a charity of participating in our process. We're trying to make it upside only, right? So, you kind of get in touch with us. We tell you what we're going to need, and we tell you if at any point we think it's becoming a waste of time, and you send stuff in, and then if it doesn't go well, nothing happens and there's no risk. And that may be something that we end up changing going forward because we think the interest in our process is increasing dramatically. So there are things we're doing to increase the likelihood. The thing that we're not doing a ton of is kind of, going after some charity that said no thank you and kind of begging them or something. I mean, that's, or anything along those lines. Although another thing we've thought about and that we're considering, because we are always brainstorming about this topic, is making some initial modest-sized grants to charities to get more on their radar screen. Because I think one thing that we now believe is that when an organization actually gets funding, they start taking the funder a lot more seriously and they become very interested in what they can do to kind of make that funding go more instead of less. So that's something we've thought about. But we're not sure what to do with that idea yet, and that's something we'll have to think more about.
Cool.
One more comment. If you go to our website and you go under research in the top navigation and then you click process, it does spell out quite a bit about this whole question of, how many organizations we've considered, what an organization has to, what has to be true about an organization for us to consider it, et cetera. So that's, we have quite a bit of detail there.
Cool. Sorry, I'll read through that in a little more detail. One last question for you: how much time and effort? How much time and effort does it take for each charity to sort of do reporting? How much time do you have to spend, or how much time does the charity have to spend to work with you? Roughly.
Yeah, it's a lot of time. It's hard to give a rough estimate. I would say that we probably spent something on the order of 6 months of a full-time person putting together the Deworm the World investigation, though it was largely handled by a new hire. And so that meant that, I think that over time that number would be lower. But it's, you know, on the order of months of a full-time person to do it. You know, I think last year when Holden and I handled most of the review for GiveDirectly, it was closer to, you know, a month and a half maybe of a full-time person.
Does it sound high to me? I mean, most of our employees do like multiple things. So you're talking about like elapsed time, not like
really.
Okay. I mean, the other thing I want to say is that time is mostly on our end. I mean, that is not.
That's the time that we spend. You know, I think from the charity side, what we often ask them to do is send us materials they already have. And so I think that they likely put some time into putting materials together to make them slightly more readable for us. But we're not asking charities to, like, submit the GiveWell report on our stationery or something, as we've, you know, seen from, you know, other funders sometimes. And what we largely ask of them is answering our questions in phone calls and email. You know, I think for the, you know, average recommended charity, it's probably something on the order of, like, a handful of long phone calls, a handful of long email exchanges, and a site visit for a few days on the ground. Before they're recommended, and then going forward, you know, on the order of a handful of phone calls and a handful of email exchanges a year.
A little bit more context on that. A lot of what takes the time on our end is the intervention report, so getting all the background information about, you know, deworming or about bed nets. What does the evidence say? How a program's gone in the past? That's where a lot of the time goes, which is why it's kind of disproportionately the work is on our end. Also, we did a survey a while ago about like how much time charities spent on our process, right? So we published the results of that, and we'll probably end up doing that again at some point.
Yeah, there's a blog post from a couple years ago, like how much time do organizations spend in GiveWell's process, which you could find.
And I think just speaking very broadly, I mean, I think overall the results were like, you know, it takes some time. It's not anything ridiculous or inordinate, and the charities didn't feel that it was, and I thought the results were like fairly credible on that front.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we've actually been talking about doing, at least with the four charities we spent the most time with over the last couple of years, is, you know, just getting some as open feedback as we can from them about, you know, what we could do better in our evaluation process of them. Obviously, you know, we're coming from a place where, you know, we can direct some funding, and so we can't be sure that they're going to be fully open with us. But, you know, we're going to try to encourage them to be, because, you know, we certainly hope that they can tell us some of the things that we've done that have made their lives most difficult so we can improve on them.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Thank you. Rob, you're back on. You're the one in the queue. If anyone else is, you know, wants to ask a question, you know, the basic instructions are the same. Either hit *6 or send an email to info@givewell.org.
Sure. My question was just, of course, a lot of your resources at the moment are going to GiveWell Labs and trying to find charities outside of the classical GiveWell global health space. And, of course, this year, the three recommendations are still similar classical GiveWell organizations. I was just wondering, can we expect that there might be any recommendations out of GiveWell Labs in the next round of recommendations come next December?
I would say probably not. And when there are recommendations on GiveWell Labs, I think they're going to take a different form. So I think, you know, there may be top charity recommendations, and it's fully possible. But, you know, there may be other ways. This is kind of what I was trying to allude to in my answer on political advocacy as well. There may just be other ways and other frameworks that are more productive for thinking about giving. And that's something that we're thinking about a lot. And so, you know, partly GiveWell Labs is targeted at larger donors. And to say to a larger donor, here are some causes that are really overlooked, and you have to go into those causes and kind of be ready with money for giving opportunities and organizations to even arise, and in some cases you need to create organizations. You know, that's the sort of form these recommendations might make. So how does a smaller individual donor participate in that sort of thing? I think there is a way, but I think that's also a question, and it may not be the very first thing that we're trying to work on in GiveWell Labs. So, you know, that's one comment about it, is that the giving opportunities won't necessarily even be structured the same way. You know, the other comment is just, we're not setting a deadline on GiveWell Labs right now, and we have a fair amount of experience with setting deadlines for ourselves. I think there are times we've done it when it's been really helpful. There are times we've done it when it's been really counterproductive. And early on in a very open-ended investigation like this, where we aren't even quite sure what we're looking for yet, I think that a deadline is counterproductive, that it makes things worse, not better. And so we're basically saying, I mean, look, there's
there's definitely some point at which it's just unacceptable. I mean, if it took more than like 5 years to start having giving opportunities, that would just not be consistent with kind of the total time we're working with here. But we're not ready to set a deadline on GiveWell Labs, and we think that's the right thing for GiveWell Labs.
Just a quick follow-up. Roughly over the last year, how has your time been split between classical GiveWell and organizing these recommendations and GiveWell Labs?
So I would say most of the time on GiveWell staff, Ellie has been the manager this year. Ellie has spent pretty much his time managing the staff as a whole. Most of the staff has been focused on traditional GiveWell work more than on GiveWell Labs work, although there's been some sort of general support. And also a lot of what we've been doing this year is like capacity building. So it's not even about getting particular work done. So it's like in some cases we have the same assignment done like several times in several ways by different people. And we've written blog posts about this too, about how kind of our vision of how capacity building works. That's where a lot of the time has gone. I and Alexander Berger have been the main ones who've worked on GiveWell Labs. I have probably spent like significantly more time on labs than on top charities, although I've spent significant time on both. And I think Alexander is probably the same. So I don't know if I had to guess, and we are actually going to total this up and we will actually answer this question, but we will actually get this number numerically because we do track our time. But if I had to guess, I would say I've been like 75-25, and Alexander probably has as well, but the rest of staff has probably been the other direction, although a lot of that has been about capacity building more than about getting particular work done.
Yeah, if you look back to the plan we published earlier in the year, one of our big goals this year was to make progress on labs. And it's worth remembering that at the beginning of the year, we were 5 full-time employees, and now we're 11 full-time employees. And so a lot of what GiveWell has done this year is grown our capacity and recruited, hired, and trained people who we hope will be able to contribute both to labs and to the traditional work that we've done in future years. And so a lot of the time, the staff time that we spent this year, as Holden has said, is with new folks. So we don't see any other questions right now in the queue or coming in over info. I think we'll stick for another 20 or 30 seconds or so in case anyone has been holding out for the end to ask a question. But barring that, I think we'll wrap up. So we'll give it, about 20, 30 seconds to see if anyone else has a question. Again, you can email into info@givewell.org or hit *6 and then 1 on your phone.
One more quick comment about labs. Just I want to say, although we don't have a deadline and although we don't have recommendations, we do have content, and so people should keep that in mind. If you go to our GiveWell Labs page, you'll see our blog posts that fit in this category. You'll see our shallow investigations, our medium investigations. So we're producing a fair amount of content. So if people want to know what GiveWell Labs is doing, what it's up to, what it's producing, that's there. So we're not saying like, hey, nothing's coming for several years. We're saying that concrete recommendations are the thing that may be a ways off.
Cool. All right, well, no one else has come through, so I think we're going to wrap up the call. Just wanted to thank everyone for joining us. I know some of you joined us at odd hours, given the time zones that you're in. We really appreciate your taking the time to engage with us on our research. One of the reasons we try to put so much out there is that, we really appreciate feedback from donors and other interested parties who are thinking critically about the work we're doing, asking questions, and pushing us on the conclusions we've reached. So thank you. And with that, have a good evening. Bye-bye.